Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Aparuta de sangamata satavara e sorvanta bamunchantu satang. So this is a special event of remembering the teacher Tanajan Cha Tenjao Kun Bodhinyana Thera. would be his 90th birthday today, 17th of June. So usually at this time I'm not here, and then we have another celebration on when he died, and on the 16th of January. That's usually, I go to Thailand for that, because that's when many big meeting and a retreat, meditation retreat event at Wat Pan Ophapong Ajahn Chah's monastery. So this is his birthday. And he of course always thought celebrating birthdays was a bit of a joke. And because in Thailand I think they have a different attitude, especially his generation. But they still, people like to celebrate birthdays. And also it gives one a chance to reflect on a great teacher that was alive. Some of us actually knew him very well. I think Ajahn Chandasiri met him, and myself, Ajahn Yanarato Panyasaro. So it was... He was the kind of inspiration for these monasteries in England, in Europe, in Australia, and New Zealand, and America. And it's quite a interesting thing to contemplate. A Thai monk in northeast Thailand who had... was relatively unknown when I first went to live in Thailand in 1966. I spent the first 6 months in Bangkok, where I was trying to find a teacher or a place to ordain. And of course, nobody then amongst the expatriate or European Buddhist community living in Bangkok at that time, nobody had ever mentioned Ajahn Chah. And Ubon is where he lived, which is the province that borders on both Laos and Cambodia. And so it was there was a huge American military base there at the time, an airfield. And this was during the Vietnam War. So there was a big B-52 airfield, or these huge monstrous planes that would go take off from Ubon and fly over and bomb Hanoi. We could even hear them sometimes taking off from the monastery, where we could hear from the monastery that they made so much noise. And this, I was the first Western monk there, so it was quite, you know, for the local people, it was quite a surprise, because they were used to Americans, American airmen, riding around on motorcycles, and so forth, but for an American to become a Buddhist monk at Wat Pa Nongpapong, which was considered the one of the most strict and disciplined and toughest monasteries in all of Thailand. And they couldn't see why I would even think of ordaining there. In fact, some people told me that 3 months in the Thai tradition, usually a man's supposed to ordain during his lifetime, at least for 3 months during the Vasa, or the rainy season retreat. And some people told me that spending one Vasa retreat at Wat Pa Pong was worth 10 years of being a monk at any other monastery. The thing that impressed me, of course, was the teacher himself, Lungpo Cha, and that it was a disciplined place. In Thailand, of course, being a Buddhist country for hundreds of years, it has the wide range of from the best to the worst. And so a lot of the, like in Bangkok, I would never have really wanted to become a monk if I had to live in the monasteries in Bangkok. And so I looked, my ideal were these forest monasteries. And by circumstances or by fate, destiny or whatever, I eventually found Lungpo Cha. And it was a strange event because he wasn't known even in Bangkok. He was becoming quite well known in the northeast Thailand, in the Isan. But as far as even Thai people that I knew in Bangkok, they'd never heard of him. So by circumstances, I met one of his disciples, a Thai monk who spoke English, and at that time I couldn't speak Thai. So this monk and he convinced me to go and spend my first Vasa as a bhikkhu with Lungpo Cha. I had the insight during the first year when I was a Samanera. I wasn't with Lungpo Cha, I was living in Nong Khai. And I had the insight there that I needed to learn how to submit, to surrender, to obey. And I had this very strong insight. If I was going to become a bhikkhu, I needed to not just be a kind of perfunctory bhikkhu or just get by. I needed to learn how. I learned how to be under somebody and live in some kind of discipline that I had no say in the matter. It was beyond my control. And so Wat Pa Pong offered this opportunity because a very traditional Thai forest monastery with very strict on the Vinaya discipline. Well, this Vinaya discipline is not an easy one for an American from California. Because this is not what we expect from life. We expect Americans have this very strong sense, I think even more so than the British, a sense of self-assertion, independence, not being dependent on anybody, proving yourself. So there's very much this strong sense of me in my cultural conditioning, the importance of me in my life and what I think and what I want. And I could see that would be an obstruction when I was, even before I met Ajahn Chah, there was too much of me in everything I did, even when I was living alone. And so I had this insight that I would try to find a very strict Vinaya monastery, which I, through circumstances, found through meeting this disciple of Ajahn Chah. So when I went to Wat Pa Pong, I I immediately kind of felt that this is what I was looking for. It was an intuitive sense of this. I'd been to many other monasteries, but never felt so strongly about staying at them. I met most of the well-known teachers in Thailand, monastic teachers, and I was very much impressed with them, but I never felt any great affinity to where I wanted to kind of train under them or live with them. But I did with Ajahn Chah. So the chemistry was right, or the karma, or whatever way you want to explain it. Once I found this monastery, I didn't really look any further. I decided to stay there as long as I could. So I was there, or in the various branches, for 10 years before coming here to England. Now, the first year, when I first went there, I couldn't speak any Thai whatsoever. And then in the Isan, they spoke a Lao dialect. So there was this problem with language. And so many people, both Thai and English, asked me, how could I possibly learn anything if there was no language, common language? Is there a fire? So this is an interesting one, because I find that meditation for me is really learning to trust an intuitive sense. During the year that I was a Samanera, as many of you have heard me talk about it before, I had tremendous insights into the Four Noble Truths. And this was not just a kind of intellectual exercise, but insight is the kind of gut knowledge, a profound and direct understanding of Dhamma. So I did have this before I met Ajahn Chah, but also part of that insight was I needed, if I was going to take the higher ordination of the bhikkhu, I needed to actually do it in a proper way, not just in a kind of traditional way. And not being Thai, I of course had a very American attitude, a Western attitude about religion and monasticism. I didn't really understand it. The Thai culture I didn't really understand, but I was open. And so a lot that I learned, both when I was living alone in the Wat Nun Panao Nong Khai, and when I went to live with Lung Po Cha in Ubon, was basically using an intuitive sense, in which is outside the particular necessity of a common language. Because the first year, I learned to speak the language, but like any of you know, that when you're living in a country whose language you don't know, it takes a while and Thai is a very different kind of language than English or languages that I had studied, French or whatever, when I was in university. So this, I had to learn how to receive a different kind of way of talking, a tonal, where tones and vowels become the necessity, and where you have to listen to understand the tone of the word, which in English, of course, is not really part of our way of speaking. The tone doesn't define the word, where in Thai, the tone that you give is, the word could have many different meanings with different tones. So this was learning to tune in to the environment, to the teacher, to the situation I was in. One thing I did appreciate was that I felt this was a very admirable monastery, and the ambience was one of practice. Ajahn Chah's main emphasis was on the practice of Dhamma. So he told me in the beginning, he said, to put away your books. You don't bother to read anything, just practice. And of course, myself, being one who loves books, became addicted to reading books. When I was a layman, I couldn't go anywhere without a book. And I felt very ill at ease. So I always had a book with me. And of course, I gave up books I couldn't have I had to learn the language. But also, I realized that what I had to do was conform. And that conformity was not a value that I ever had. In fact, when I was in the university, I saw myself as a nonconformist. I prided myself as being a nonconformist, and that conformity was for idiots. So there's a kind of conceit I had when I was a young man. And I'd been in the military where you had to conform, and that was enough, you know, 4 years of the U.S. Navy was enough for that. And then the kind of expressing yourself and living your life and self-assertion and proving yourself, and also nonconformity appealed to me, a sense of freedom to do whatever I felt like doing. Then finding myself in this monastery where the only way I could stay there was by conforming. There were no kind of agreements or negotiations about, you know, I don't particularly want to do this or that, you just did whatever, you know. And then I was a newly ordained bhikkhu when I went there. Ajahn Chah was, you know, wouldn't give me any special privileges either, because, you know, many people felt that being a Western monk, I'd have trouble with the food, and of course everything was new for me, the type of food and the climate was hot, and the customs, the language, everything was different than what I was accustomed to as a layperson. So it did demand a kind of conformity, a blind conformity. But within that conformity, Lungpa Cha was not. It wasn't like a concentration camp or the military. There was a purpose to it. The conformity was the way that we agreed to live together for mindfulness. So Ajahn Chah's emphasis was always on cultivating awareness and mindfulness. Well, of course, this is as you know, is the essence, is the essential. And when I chant the gate to the deathless is open, the gate is actually mindfulness. It's our ability to awaken, to be fully present and receptive in the here and now moment. So then the conditions, whatever they might be, are no longer the essence or the thing that one is seeking to control and manipulate the condition realm, but the agreement to live within the structure of the discipline in order for mindfulness, not for blind conformity or just being a kind of puppet or a toy soldier marching in step. And that's, of course, how I viewed it at first, was just you had, you know, this kind of conformity was seemed not that much different from naval training. But in naval training, it was all about reward and punishment, about, you were conforming out of fear, out of you know, you would be ostracized, punished, or for not conforming and humiliated, especially in the preliminary training for the military. But this was, of course, I chose to be in this monastery. I could have left at any time, and then there was a high sense of moral commitment. There was this training in morality and in renunciation. I knew I needed that. I needed to have boundaries for behavior. Boundaries that I had no right or ability to change according to my own wishes. So this is why I emphasize it. What is a tradition? It's a package thing you get to conform to in order to watch and observe the restraint, the grasping, the rebellion, whatever emotions arise within these conditions. Lungpho Cha was a very wise human being, and this I felt right from the beginning that this was, you know, he kind of was like the kind of person I would like to be. I'd never really met a wise person before or lived with one for very long. I met wise teachers, but as I said before, I didn't have any great interest in living with them. But living with Lungpho Cha was the more I began to tune in to him on this intuitive level. I realized that he could have wisdom, compassion, were very much a part of the life. So it wasn't just like a learning to march in step and do everything mechanically, but to learn how to simplify one's life to where we could actually live together and develop awareness, mindfulness. Now most people are mindful to a certain degree, but it's not a value of our society. I don't even remember using the word mindfulness before I became a monk. When I became a monk, started meditating, the emphasis was on concentration. It was all about samadhi. And of course, I'd read many books on samadhi and on yoga and Vedanta and whatnot. So this word samadhi, was like created this sense of something you attain. You've got to get samadhi, and that's very much how the Western monks or Western Buddhists in Bangkok talked, is getting, attaining samadhi. So, you know, I had this same mindset of getting and attaining these states of concentration. And what Lungpho Cha was challenging that, this attaining mind, because it was about receptivity and awakening in the present, not as an attainment, but as letting go. The whole emphasis was on letting go of desire for attaining. So that was quite a revelation to realize, you know, the motivation was to become, to get samadhi or get states, higher states of consciousness, to get something I didn't have yet, and or to get rid of the negativity, the defilements, the kilesas, the faults, the weaknesses that I have, is to get rid of them, get rid of the bad, and try to get hold of the good. And so this was how my thinking mind, my personality operated, was very much on that level of attaining and getting rid of, was annihilating, getting, destroying defilements, kilesas, and attaining high levels of consciousness. So then this, of course, Dzogchen would could challenge just by pointing to you know, he was able to get me to look at what I was actually doing, and what I was thinking, and what my own emotional reactions to the restraint, to the frustration of training as a Buddhist monk, learning another language, getting used to a different type of diet, learning to conform, obey, follow, know your place within the structure. This was all something that brought up a lot of resistance, conceit, pride, and rebelliousness. But rather than you know, the important thing was seeing the suffering caused from attaching to these reactions. So intuitively, I kind of understood this. The reason why I went and put myself into such a situation was during that year in Nong Khai, I did have that kind of insight. But the momentum of my karma was very much based on attaining and achieving, getting rid of, purifying, which meant to me, from the ego level, to purify was to get rid of, to annihilate, kill the defilements, you know, the axis of evil, the terrorists, the punish the criminals, behead the heretics, and so forth. Even though on an intellectual level I didn't like that, yet actually emotionally I was very much conditioned toward this achieving, attaining, by getting rid of and suppressing. Now, like, mindfulness then is not like suppressing, denying anything, but it's allowing what has been suppressed, what has been denied, one's feelings, emotions, reactions to life into consciousness, so that, and then one can be mindful what arises in the consciousness. So this is interesting to contemplate how consciousness works, because the Western model of consciousness was one of it being within the body, like the, you know, it was really associated very much with the brain. And yet, in the Vipassana practices, in the reflection on Four Noble Truths and insights, is that you're actually, by letting go, and letting go of conditions is not suppressing or denying or annihilating anything. It's just letting them be what they are. So learning to accept, let the mood, my rebellious mood or anger or resentments or jealousies or fears, when they would arise, to let them be and be the awareness itself of these emotions. And then you have the insight into their impermanence and their anatta, or not self. So, and when training in a strict monastery, there's a lot of rules that I thought were foolish or silly or unnecessary, basically because I'm quite a lazy person at heart, and I don't like fussiness and all the picayune kind of discipline and rules, and so I find it annoying. I'm, you know, like the grand gestures of life, the great ideals, but I've always felt very annoyed, irritated at the kind of detailed fussiness that some people seem to be obsessed with. Well, I had to deal with this feeling of being irritated, frustrated, and also I began to see the suffering. Was it the rules, the the little rules, the fussiness of the way you had to do it in a certain way, was that the cause of suffering, or was my just not wanting to be bothered, my own conceit, thinking these are not necessary, and that. So I began to, you know, investigate, looking into the causes of suffering was not wanting, like not wanting all this fussiness around the rules. In the Thai monasteries, you have in the rainy season a lot of mosquitoes. So I contemplated mosquitoes a lot because there were so many, and of course in. When you become a Buddhist monk, you can't kill anything with intention. So, and then in the rainy season, there's this thing, kind of you're sitting in a meditation hall like this, and they didn't have screens or mosquito screens or any way of stopping them, so they'd come in and you could have these irritating bites and buzzing sounds, and it would bring up so much anger and aversion and desire to get rid of them. I could actually begin to see, contemplating this desire to annihilate what I don't like, just by contemplating the reality of mosquitoes. Because, I didn't like them. They're not lovable. They never do become lovable. One never, after 40 years, likes mosquitoes. If they're just unlikable, irritating creatures. But you don't believe that anymore. You don't follow that emotion because your relationship to them is compassion rather than just getting rid of what you don't like and what irritates you. Well, that, to be able to do that, was to have to expand my vision of life. And this is what Lungpo Cha offered, an expanded vision of consciousness, a kind of unlimited consciousness that was receptive, intelligent, and which one could actually begin to observe the conditioning, the ego, how my ego, my sense of myself, how that operated. I began to observe it like it's an object rather than the subject. Like the unawakened human individual, the ego is how you operate. You interpret all experience through the sense of me and mine, myself. So when I, during those first years of training, of course, I interpreted, I had to live with this ego, conceited arrogance that comes from being born in the society that I'm from. Because, like in the American sense, I'm from the kind of privileged group of Americans, and so you have a sense of even though I never considered myself, I didn't like the idea of snobbery or superciliousness, arrogance, and that I did have a basic assumption of somehow superiority that I had never really contemplated. And just through the awareness, through this surrender and awareness, through mindfulness, awareness, with consciousness, I began to see a lot of the cultural assumptions that I'd never noticed before. And as we know here at Amaravati, because it's so international, we are all from different places, so we have cultural assumptions from, whether you're from Japan or Thailand or Sri Lanka or Germany or whatever, whether you like it or not, you've got a certain mindset, certain way of looking that comes from the cultural conditioning. And how do we get beyond that is through this awareness. Because pure consciousness isn't created by human beings. It's a Dhamma. It's natural. It's not a cultural condition. So you can't claim consciousness as American consciousness or Japanese consciousness. Consciousness is consciousness. It's in a male or female, it's consciousness. It's not a female consciousness and a male consciousness. So in the, Asian consciousness and a European consciousness. And yet that's very much how the ego works in this very dualistic way of thinking, you know, Asia and Europe and Buddhism, Mahayana, Hinayana, Theravada. Then there's Hinduism and Christianity, Islam, Judaism, goes on like that. So we have these very culturalism. Like I was brought up as a Christian. So even though I kind of lost faith and lost interest in it, I have a very Christian mindset, you know, culturally speaking. Very dualistic, and this is good, and this is bad, and heaven, hell, and this is the kind of assumptions that one makes from the religious and cultural conditioning I received. Now, with Lungpo Cha, because of the mindfulness, emphasis on mindfulness, one can get behind that kind of conditioning. The conceit of one's cultural conditioning, or the sense of being better or inferior, superiority or inferiority, whatever. Because consciousness doesn't have any of that. It's not about inferiority or superiority. It's not about a higher consciousness either. Like we're somehow at a lower level of consciousness and we have to attain a higher one. Because that is still a very dualistic way of perceiving it. So the emphasis was on mindfulness, which is the simplicity of awakened presence here and now. It's not about higher. It's about here and now, where higher no longer is an issue, higher or lower. And in this consciousness, then the higher and lower, refined and coarse, can manifest, arise and cease according to other conditions. So this is the training that I received from Lungpo Cha was very much this emphasis on mindfulness. Well, I found it the first year where I couldn't really understand the teaching. Lungpo Cha was at his peak, really, at his best during those 10 years that I lived with him. He was brilliant, expounding Dhamma. But the first couple of years, I could hardly understand it, anything he said. You know, like, because of language. But in an intuitive sense, I kind of connected on that level, so I could bear with the frustration of not being able to understand or the language, or as I began to understand it, you know, I had to struggle and kind of, because I did tend to interpret Thai into English words. So there's the first couple of years I really appreciate, because I mean, even though it might have seemed looking back, I just feel incredibly grateful for that, for all the frustration and difficulties that I experienced. And at the time, I remember it was, you know, what am I doing here, you know, this, you know, I had the way the mind would find fault and feel all kinds of, I would get strong sense of paranoia sometimes. When you're living in a culture that's very different from your own, and they react differently, and then you don't know what's going on, And so you get, I would start getting paranoid, start interpreting, misinterpreting all kinds of actions and reactions to things. But Lumpa Cha's emphasis was on awareness, not on, you know, trying to figure it all out and to have, you know, before I could actually develop mindfulness and meditation, I'd have to learn to speak fluent Thai. There was no suggestion of that I even had to learn Thai. It was about practice, and practice was always on its level of mindfulness. So we actually had to do a lot of work. Lungpa Cha was always great at finding work projects for us, which I didn't like, because I wanted to practice, and I like that of sitting and getting very tranquil, because I can concentrate my mind, I can get very tranquil, and I quite like that. But then if you're working, like we had to do laboring work, building things and building walls. I still today, when I go to Wat Pa Pong, we built this really ugly wall, which still exists, but they built a better wall later, because Wat Pa Pong tended to expand. But when I lived there, we built this very ugly wall, which I was very much part of building this ugly thing. And bricklaying and rendering bricks and all this was something, you know, I'm very much a person that, you know, likes to sit and read books, not do that kind of work. We helped build a road one time, just, you know, on a hill in the province of Amnat Chalern. So, I mean, this was, and yet, when I look back, this was a very important part of the training, because bricklaying or rendering bricks or building roads is not an obstruction to mindfulness. It might disrupt your, you know, your refined samadhi, but basically, Lungpa Cha was always pointing at the here and now, so we actually had to learn how to live a monastic life, we had to make our robes, dye them in the jackfruit dye. Everything was kind of old and tedious. There was no kind of instant things available. There was no electricity in the monastery. It was all very quite primitive. No running water. We had to use wells and things like this. Lungpa Cha kept us always working on this very low level of technology, like drawing water from wells and sweeping. We had to keep the monastery very clean, so we swept paths. We had to make our own brooms out of branches, sew our own robes. We were allowed to use sewing machines, these treadle sewing machines, because we didn't have electricity, and then dye them in this jackfruit dye, which is quite, you know, takes a lot of time and patience to make. So just the lifestyle, just the way of living, having to every morning go out on the alms round into villages, and the highly structured life we lived, I found, you know, I didn't, you know, I, the first year, I put up with it, you know, I kind of grin and bear it, grit my teeth, but my ideal was to go off by myself. And so I told Ajahn Chah I wanted to go off by myself to this remote place where we didn't have to work all the time, and where I didn't have to live with a lot of other monks. And of course he kept refusing me, and then finally he said, okay, and let me go. So I spent 6 months in a very beautiful place, but I also had 6 months of hell, which was my mind. It was not due to the place. And so I began to, you know, just figure it out. When I operate on just what I want, I could see every time in my monastic life that I've tried to manipulate conditions for my own benefit, it seems to have this very kind of reaction. A lot of things go wrong, and even though I've rationalizations justify my own views, that just doing, following my own desires, even if they're very good desires, where things always seem to go wrongly. And the reactions were always very unpleasant. So during that time, I began to just see to give up that, to just live like step by step in the moment. And even though one appreciates that as an ideal, as a concept, to actually do that is not an easy thing to do, because we are, especially here in modern affluent societies, very much programmed for goals, reaching goals and duty, getting things done and going places and whatnot. I feel very fortunate that I was able to live there for 10 years in the Isan, because now it's changed. Thailand's become a very modern country. Those 10 years from 66 actually, to 1977, when I came to live here, Thailand became a very modern country. It was changing during those 10 years, but where I lived, it was still like old-fashioned Thailand or Laos. It wasn't, the roads weren't very good and everything was quite basic and like old rice-growing villages, farming communities we lived near always these farming, rice farming villages. And I began, as I learned the language and understand the dialect, I began to appreciate the kind of quality of life of these Northeast Thai rice farming communities. There's a certain loveliness and graciousness that I found very appealing. So whenever I hear the Isan dialect or Lao, it's a kind of heartwarming feeling, that particular sound of Northeast Thailand has a particularly heartwarming reaction in my heart, because it was those 10 years where I transformed from being very egotistical, self-centered individual towards one who's actually living by letting go of that, freeing myself from the suffering of my ego, my thoughts, my memories, my emotions. So then when I came to live here in England, it was, quite a, changing. I learned the basics, I've never had trouble here in England. I've never doubted about the practice. I've had many doubts about many other things, but the actual practice that I learned through those 10 years with Lungpa Cha, that was very clear. And so then coming to live here in this country, and of course the first 2 years we lived in London, living in a big city, after living so many years in the rural rice-growing areas, quite quite interesting effect. But you could actually watch your, the effects it had. I remember first getting used to the London Underground. It used to terrify me. And if you've been to like Belsize Park or Hampstead Underground Station, you have to go down very deep, through stairways into these tunnels, and it just seemed so kind of frightening in a way. Crowds of people running about, rushing here and there, entering, leaving trains, and it all seemed so complicated. And just developing that an awareness around a city life, a modern city, living in a house, and we lived in northwest London in Hampstead, and that was quite a nice part of London to live in, but still, it was very different from what I was used to. But the emphasis has always been on the mindfulness rather than, nostalgia or believing your own emotional reactions. During that first year, I wanted to go back to Thailand. I had so many problems the first year at the Hampstead Vihara. And so I was, really didn't want to be in such a situation where there was so much acrimony and everybody was looking at me to solve all the problems. So before Lung Po Cha left to return to Thailand in 1977, we came together, but then he only stayed a short while and returned. He made me promise I wouldn't go back to Thailand for 5 years. So I make a promise. I'm a very loyal disciple, so I promised him. And that was a very wise thing for him to do, because I probably would have gone back first year. But also I actually knew how to practice with the problems and difficulties, both internally in myself and the external problems that I was witnessing. And after the first year, a lot of those problems seemed to go, and the second year everything seemed to be required Chithurst, and the whole kind of sense of flourishing developed things, everything seemed to go right. And during this time, I remember living with Lung Po Cha at his monastery, Wat Pa Phong. I came at a time where there were very few monks. There were only 22 of us monks in the monastery at the time. Now there's, it's expanded enormously, but we were all very devoted to Ajahn Chah. We were there, all of the monks were there for him. So we all looked to him as our teacher. So there was no conflict on that level, like other monks competing or that. Whatever Lung Po Cha said, we did that. And that made life very easy. So he could torture us. He used to the food. They eat sticky rice there, which is glutinous rice, which I quite like. But also he'd mix all the food together. You get the rice separate in your alms bowl, but then the lay people bring these tiffin carriers with nice little curries and whatnot, and he dumped them all in one big basin, and you get chicken and pork and fish all mixed together in this kind of horrible mixture of different flavors, and then we ladle it out into the alms bowls of the monks. Well, that is first I found that just totally disgusting way to eat, and but I learned to eat that way. the first month I couldn't eat it. I ate just mangoes. I arrived during the mango season. Mangoes and sticky rice. But after that, when the mangoes stopped, then I had to learn to eat the rest. And I did. I began to just, you know, reflect on, you know, the reaction, the aversion, the that I felt, and wanting it to be otherwise. And this is what Lungpa Cha wanted us to do, to be able to observe, you know, how we don't, none of the monks probably liked the food. It was made very unlikable, but we learned to eat that. And then there would be days where we would, we'd be invited out. I remember a big wealthy woman in Ubon, in the city of Ubon, who had movie theaters. And she was of Chinese ancestry. And when she invited us, then we knew we were in for a really good meal, Chinese. And I'm ashamed to tell you how greedy it made me. Even eating this kind of stuff. And then suddenly, you know, your face, you have given all this wonderful Chinese food and that you can choose, and that I mean, almost out of control. But this is how you learn, you know, how you learn about greed and aversion and so forth. Food is a very important part of it, because, like, food does bring up the greed and aversion in very obvious ways. So everything was used for this mindfulness practice, because there were a lot of wonderful times, and also, you know, learning to, as I became more understanding of the language, I learned to read the Thai. Lungpa Cha especially liked Buddhadasa's writings. So we always had, Buddhadasa was one of the famous monks of that time, lived in southern Thailand. And so he was, a lot of his pamphlets and that, they have published these little booklets and pamphlets of his teaching. I learned to read Thai through reading Buddhadasa and Buddhatat, and then, but Buddhatat was also teaching in this similar way of attention, here and now attention, awareness. So the result is, you know, when I think of Ajahn Chah, I always have this sense of Gatanyu Gataveti, which is gratitude, because, you know, it was very, I feel this feeling of incredible gratitude for meeting him and for learning. He was a very charming person, had a great sense of humor. He was a very earthy person. He wasn't like floating up in the skies, living with angels and devadas, but he was actually a very earthy, practical man. And he also understood the human condition. Like the thing I learned, and I really appreciate living in the Thai monastery those years, was there, it's a much more kind of, it's not idealistic. Like in northeast Thailand, because they're farmers, mainly rice-growing communities, they're very much aware of the environment and the earth and the things around, the very kind of earthbound conditions. And being Buddhists, they also have, they're not living according to ideals of how they would like life to be. They have an acceptance of life, both in its pleasurable and unpleasurable experiences. They seem to know, like Lungpa Cha seemed to know, that things change. You can't keep things at a peak and and make everything, control everything to fit your ideal. And this was very important to me because when I first went there, of course, I kind of idealized the monastery. I thought, this is the perfect monastery. And then as I lived there for 3 years, past 4 years, and then I began to see things I didn't like about it. I began to become very critical, and I began to notice, you know, it wasn't like it used to be. It's degenerating. And so I thought I'd better warn Lungpo Cha, you know, the expert, me. So I remember going to him and warning him and saying, you know, it's not like it used to be. This isn't like it used to be and that. And he just said, it's changing. And here I was trying to ignite him, you know, to get him to say, we've got to bring it back to what it was. And he was laughing at me. And he loved to say, oh, Sumedho loves to suffer. And because, you know, it's such an idealistic person. So idealistic and high-minded. And I had visions of how, you know, I wanted Wat Bapong to be like this and stay in this, the way that I idealized it. And when I saw it changing, of course, it doesn't change for the better, it changes for the worse. And so then I began to feel this kind of fear that it's all degenerating. Well, Lungpo Cha wouldn't go along with that. He's pointing to change rather than to an ideal, perfect peak monastery. And that, when I couldn't get arouse him, fear in Ajahn Chah, or concern about the changing conditions that I thought was degenerating, I began to observe, because he had a very powerful effect to get me to look at how I actually was feeling. And I could see this desire, you know, this kind of conceit that my ideal of what Wat Bapong was and what it should be, and that I didn't particularly like the way it was going at the present time. And everything was reflected in this consciousness. You know, I could see this. I want it to be like this. I don't want it to change like that. I don't. And so I, just by observing this, how my personality would and my critical mind would operate, and then Lungpo Cha's lack of concern about change, and I was always pointing at change rather than at how things should be or how things were at a previous time. Later on, some of his, as Wat Bapong became more modernized, and electricity and the wells were changed, we had pumps on the wells, and we had, everything was modernized. There is a lot of criticism of that because the ideal was this very primitive monastery. But I could see in myself that you can't hold things down to an ideal standard. That life is about change, and things change for the better, and then they change for the worse. They don't keep changing for the better. And they get better and better. They get better and then they get worse. And apply that to your own state of mind, you know, to the fears, anxieties, your emotional habits and views and opinions and physical conditions. Like now, I'll be 75 next month, three quarters of a century, 75, does have this perception of being very old, even when you're 75. You know, I don't feel old, but the perception of 75, because I acquired the perception of 75 as old age when I was a child. In fact, 60 was old age, or 40, even 30. But as you get older, the aging process, 50 used to seem old. Now 50 seems young. 60, I think, mere child. 60, 70, old. And I can't really say young anymore, or people keep saying, you're still young, and I'm not. I mean, I don't want to be young. In terms of this path, this is what I learned from old age and the changes that come through the body. The aging process is to learn, is not to identify. We resent getting old from the ego level, you know. I want people to tell me how young I am, and because my ego is conditioned to see myself as you know, like when you say you're old, it's kind of insulting in a Western context. But for me, you see it in terms of Dhamma rather than in terms of vanity or attachment to the body. As if I'm this body, it's definitely old, an old body, and it feels old. Yet in mentally, I don't feel old. It's kind of ageless, because consciousness has no age. And so this is where we began, and say, with meditation, is to begin to recognize, awaken to pure consciousness. And this is why we call it the deathless. And I was giving a retreat in Portugal last week, and I kept emphasizing this over and over, the deathlessness, because this is a word that you can't imagine. You know, you can't make an image out of deathlessness. And the word death itself has an ominous ring, doesn't it? You know, in polite circles, it's not really, not a subject that you talk about at the dinner table. You know, it's not very nice, death, in Western social circles. And old age, you don't, you know, you talk about babies and the beautiful things of life, being politically correct, being nice, and not mentioning that somebody's old or that somebody passed away. They put it in a less stark terms than somebody we knew is dead, because that has a kind of finality to it. And the deathless, then, what is that? This is what is apparent through mindfulness. This is an insight into the deathless. It's a reality. It's not a imagined or refined state. It's so simple, so real. We bypass it. We miss it all the time because on the conditioned level, we're so bound up in our own thoughts, memories, emotional habits, identity with the body, that we, you know, it's hard to, you know, that's our world. How we create the world around us is through the conditioning, always defining and judging, criticizing, and picking and choosing among the conditions, where the unconditioned or the deathless is with us all the time, but we forget or we don't notice. So what mindfulness is, it's that gate, that door, that which is open to us in the present moment all the time when we recognize it. And so the aim of this monastery, Amaravati, is to recognize the deathless. You know, that's the name of what Amaravati means, deathless realm. Well, it's not trying to point to the place, but it's a reminder of what we're here for, is this awakened attentiveness till we we know it's what they call jnana dasana. It's a profound knowing, a direct knowing, not from concepts anymore or ideas, but we know this pure knowing, consciousness with mindfulness and wisdom, and then that is the liberation that the Buddha was pointing to. And this is very much what Lungpa Cha, the essence of his teaching was about, and the life that we lived in this monastery was, its sole purpose was for this awakened consciousness with mindfulness and wisdom. Now all beings are conscious, but not mindful or wise. So consciousness isn't something you lack, is it? It's something you always, you know, we're conditioned to create into our consciousness, ourselves, our views and opinions, our fears, our desires, and so forth. When we see the suffering we create by doing that, then we let go. And then that is the path, the way of non-suffering. And this is, they say, budgetang weti dapo, we need to be realized individually. It's nothing that somebody else can do for you. So on this auspicious day, 17 June, maybe we'll chant this gratitude, the Amina chant, for sharing the blessings of our lives with all the teachers and parents and that. This is one of the finest, most kind of generous chants that a human being can possibly think up. So I'll stop here.